the headlines, Iran once again says the U.S. should fully comply with the 2015 nuclear deal first, then Iran will reciprocate following rapid verification of Washington's compliance. The World Health Organization laments a shocking imbalance in the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines worldwide. And India reports another record number of new COVID-19 infections as daily deaths hit their highest in more than 5 months. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says that Tehran is proposing a logical path to the U.S. for its full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. Zarif said the United States should first return to the full compliance, and then Iran will reciprocate after rapid verification of Washington's compliance. Zarif also stressed that all sanctions imposed by former President Donald Trump must be removed. This comes as Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal and another round of talks aimed at reviving the agreement. More negotiations are set to be held next Wednesday. Iran's top nuclear negotiator says the country must see the effects of the removal of U.S. sanctions in practice before it returns to compliance with the 2015 deal.
Well, what we mean by verification is to see the effects of sanctions lifting in practice. So it is not enough for the U.S. to sign, you know, waivers or, I don't know, executive orders, whatever. Yes, they have to officially sign, but what matters for us is to see the effect of sanction lifting on the ground.
Abbas Araghchi made the remarks in an exclusive interview with Press TV upon the conclusion of the current round of talks in Vienna. He said Iran insists on verifying U.S. removal of sanctions. Araghchi stressed that all sanctions imposed, reimposed, and relabeled under the former U.S. administration must be reversed. The Iranian deputy foreign minister said almost all of the participants in the talks agreed that the U.S. must remove sanctions first to rejoin the deal before Iran resumes its compliance. He said the talks are heading in the right direction and progress is being made, but more work still remains to be done. Political commentator Saib Shah says the remarks by Robert Malley indicate that the U.S. wants to draw a positive roadmap to the future.
Robert Malley, who's the special envoy to Iran from the United States of America, his remarks were, positive. He said they will agree on a roadmap that will lead to return of the commitments of the two parties, which is the United States of America and Iran, and lift of the sanctions that are not fit, he stated, with the agreement that concluded with Iran. To me, this is, even he before that, the Mali statement last week, he said, and before, he said these sanctions not working and shouldn't be there. This is this kind of remarks by Mali. It's a positive roadmap to the future.
The Yemeni army says it has carried out a successful drone strike against targets at Saudi Arabia's Abha International Airport. Yemeni Army spokesman Yahya Sari'i said the strike conducted by a Qasif 2K drone was in response to Saudi Arabia's escalation of aggression and continued siege of Yemen. However, the Saudi-led coalition claims it intercepted and destroyed a Yemeni explosives-laden drone heading toward Khamis Mush'ait, a city east of Abha. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Yemeni forces have been carrying out retaliatory attacks since then. They vowed to continue the raids until Saudi Arabia stops its aggression. The UN Human Rights Office says it's still awaiting proof of life for Sheikha Latifa, the daughter of Dubai's ruler. Spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Marta Hurtado, said the UN wants clear, compelling evidence that the princess is alive. In a video message published in mid-February, the princess had said she was being held hostage in fears for her life. Latifa tried to escape the country in 2018 but was captured and returned back to the UAE. The UN spokeswoman also said senior officials have sought a meeting with the UAE ambassador in Geneva, and on the issue, that is, she said they were also planning to raise the case of Latifa's older sister, Shamsa, who was kidnapped in Cambridge at the age of 18 and has not been seen in public ever since. The head of the World Health Organization has lamented a, quote, shocking imbalance in the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines worldwide. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said most countries do not have enough shots to inoculate high-risk groups. Ghebreyesus noted that almost one in four people has received a COVID-19 vaccine on an average in high-income countries. He added that in low-income countries, however, only one in more than 500 people has been inoculated against the disease. Earlier this week, the WHO chief also warned that fair distribution remains one of the major barriers to ending the acute stage of the pandemic. So far, nearly 650 million doses of COVID vaccines have been administered to people around the world. Figures show over 60% has been administered in high-income countries. Well, Japan has imposed new month-long restrictions in the capital, Tokyo, and some other regions to combat surging coronavirus infections.
Today, I have decided to place Tokyo, Kyoto, and Okinawa under expanded coronavirus measures. The period for Tokyo will be from April 12th to May 11th. For Kyoto and Okinawa, it will be April 12th to May 5th. I have made this decision because there's a growing number of new COVID-19 cases and concerns about the strains they cause for medical services in these areas.
The Premier further said that the new curbs were needed to prevent outbreaks from turning into a nationwide wave. He also noted that highly contagious variants represent 70% of cases in Osaka and Hyogo and 20% in Tokyo. Earlier this week, authorities warned that new variants are driving a possible fourth wave of the pandemic in the country. Japan has twice declared a state of emergency since the outbreak of the disease. According to Japanese media, total COVID cases crossed half a million mark, 1,000 on Friday, with fatalities standing at over 9,000. Total confirmed coronavirus cases in the U.S. are nearing 31 million. That's according to data by the country's Johns Hopkins University. The data also show that more than 560,000 Americans have lost their lives to the virus. The U.S. has the largest case count and death toll in the world. The country's Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say more than 20,000 infections are related to the new variants of the coronavirus. It says a majority of those infections have been caused by the British strain. The U.S. began its COVID vaccination program in mid-December 2020. President Joe Biden has said all American adults will be eligible for the vaccine by April 19th. And India has reported another record number of new COVID-19 infections, while daily deaths there hit the highest in more than 5 months. The country reported nearly 132,000 new infections and around 800 deaths on Friday. This is the biggest daily increase in fatalities since mid-October. This, as the world's second most populous country is battling a second wave of infections. The government blames the resurgence mainly on crowding and people's reluctance to wear masks. The second surge has already been faster than the first, which peaked in September last year with 97,000 cases a day. India's overall caseload has swelled to over 13 million and total deaths to over 167,000. The country is the third biggest victim of the pandemic after the U.S. and Brazil. Munawar Zaman says the Indian government is taking steps to curb the virus, but people don't care enough about health protocols anymore.
As you can see me, I'm driving right now, but the mask is compulsory. If I will remove my mask, I can be fined up to 2,000 Indian rupees. There are some steps that the government has taken in the recent weeks, but it looks like people have started taking the issue very lightly. I mean, people don't care a lot about the virus. In the recent weeks, there has been a lot of election campaigns in the southern Indian states and in northeast, and the places of worship, they have gone open, the markets are open, people are not following the guidelines properly. At the same time, I've spoken with one of the top Indian medical research center yesterday, and experts said that this is the second wave, and it is going to last for another 4 weeks or so, but after that, we can see the curve coming down to some extent. But many more experts say that this is going to be more deadly at the same time when India is battling a huge shortage of vaccine, despite the fact it has rolled out a biggest vaccination campaign in the world. But the vaccine shortage is running in the states of Maharashtra and in the states of Punjab.
Indian police say 7 pro-independence fighters have been killed in separate clashes with security forces in the disputed Kashmir region. 5 people were killed in the southern town of Shopian in Indian-controlled Kashmir during a shootout that started Thursday. Police said a top militant commander fighting Indian rule was among those killed. 2 others were killed in a gun battle in the Tral area of southern Kashmir. Friday marked the deadliest day in the region in over 7 months. Kashmir has been split between India and Pakistan since 1947. The countries have fought 3 wars over the region. Indian troops are in constant clashes with the armed groups seeking independence across the Muslim-majority valley. We look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this edition, Russia has expressed concern over what it calls increased activities in the Black Sea by governments that do not border its waters. Russian media have quoted Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko as saying that all movements by warships in the Black Sea must be in line with the 1936 Montreux Convention. The convention gives Turkey control over 2 straits within its borders and regulates the transit of warships from other states. However, the U.S. has recently informed Turkey that it intends to send 2 of its warships through the straits to the Black Sea. Tensions have been running high between Moscow and Washington since President Joe Biden entered the White House. Russia said on Thursday it was moving more than 10 Navy vessels to the Black Sea to take part in planned exercises. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Katerina Katina, war reporter at Newsfront, joining us from Donetsk. Also from Budapest, we have senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute, Mr. George Samueli. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Ms. Katina in Donetsk. Talk to us about Russia's concerns at this point.
Concerns are really serious and valid because, as we can see, when Joe Biden came to the presidency in the United States, the level of threats is rising a bit. And we know that we had some kind of incidents before. In February, in the Black Sea, there were some NATO warships. And again, it was a problem. It was some issue for worrying for Moscow. And besides, there is also a problematic and very serious situation in Donbas. Maybe you know that now there is escalation from the Ukraine side. And the level of shelling has risen. Maybe you've heard that a 5-year-old boy was killed by the Ukrainian drone in Alexandrovskaya. So all these facts, all these situations really now concern Moscow, because when Joe Biden came to power, all these threats now became more visible.
Mr. Samueli, your thoughts on the issue right now. As we mentioned earlier, Russia has expressed concern over what it's called increasing activities in the Black Sea by governments that do not border its waters. Unpack that for us, please.
Well, of course, there is a great deal of understandable concern in Moscow because President Zelensky of Ukraine has given indications that he wants to mount an offensive against the breakaway republics of Donetsk and Lugansk. And he has enjoyed a considerable amount of support from the United States and to a lesser extent the United Kingdom. So he's now this announcement that came today that 2 U.S. warships will enter the Black Sea next week and will stay for some 3 weeks are obviously matters of great concern, because I have to think about, well, what actually is the U.S. Zelensky end game here. Remember, Zelensky said just 2-3 days ago that he wants immediate NATO membership. And so, obviously, that is a serious issue. Now, what the United States is trying to do is, of course, difficult to grasp, because they're sending these warships, and they're explicitly saying, well, we are trying to send a message to Moscow that we stand with our allies, Ukraine. Well, what exactly does that mean? Does that mean that you're ready to go to war on behalf of Ukraine against Russia? If you're not, then this kind of behavior is absolute recklessness, because they may well be encouraging the hotheads in Kiev to believe that if they mount an offensive in the southeast of Ukraine, then they will have the backing of the United States. So now, either the United States will go to war, which would be absolutely catastrophic, or the United States will then sit back and watch Ukraine suffer catastrophic defeat in the hands of Russia. So the U.S. game is kind of baffling and at best, and reckless at worst.
Ms. Katina, ever since Joe Biden entered the White House, he's had a sort of a pressuring approach towards Russia. Do you think that this approach of antagonizing Moscow will be effective, or will it ultimately backfire on Washington?
Well, I think it's a big provocation. We now see that the USA try to provoke Russia for some serious actions to give the answer to the Ukrainian authorities, you know, to stop their violent behavior. But we see the rhetoric of Russia that everything should be done in the diplomatic way. So I think Russia will, I think they will, in the same, they will keep the same position of the diplomatic way to solve this problem. But as for Ukraine, I think we cannot talk about some big offense, a big attack towards Donbas, but we can talk about small escalation on the front line, or maybe even the Ukrainian forces will try to liberate some small towns or villages, you know, to make some kind of a victory, because now they are backed by the USA. Joe Biden something like gave them the green light. But still, we will see how it works. As we can see now, Russia is ready to help Donbas, will defend the citizens, because we know that in Donbas there are already lots of people with the Russian passports. But still, everything will be done.
All right, thanks a lot. George Samueli joining us from Budapest. Also, thanks to Katerina Katina joining us from Donetsk. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
Astronomers recently found a tantalizing hint that life could be wafting through the clouds shrouding Venus. But it seems the hunt for extraterrestrial life is far from over, as new research is already calling that discovery into question. Stay with us for an article penned by Nadia Drake, a contributing writer at National Geographic, under the heading, "Promising Sign of Life on Venus Might Not Exist After All." The detection of phosphine gas in Venus's atmosphere announced last month ignited a firestorm of speculation about whether the gas could be produced by alien microbes on the planet, where NASA is currently considering sending a spacecraft. However, three independent studies now have failed to find evidence of phosphine in the Venusian atmosphere. One of the groups used archival observations to search for signs of the gas in the planet's clouds and didn't find it. Connor Nixon, a planetary scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, says, "They're saying they don't see the phosphine. That's really problematic." The study has been peer-reviewed and accepted for publication in Astronomy and Astrophysics. Two other groups reprocessed the discovery team's original data and also couldn't find evidence of phosphine. But detecting a faint signal from a specific molecule on another planet is a complex process, and the original study authors are not surprised that other scientists are taking a closer look at their work. Clara Sousa Silva of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, one of the authors, says, "This is normal. This is what science looks like. If this was data that could have just looked at with the naked eye and seen phosphine, it would have been discovered a long time ago." The initial detection, published in the journal Nature Astronomy in September, found that more than 1,000 times the amount of phosphine gas in Earth's atmosphere is floating through the thick sulfuric clouds of Venus. On rocky worlds like Venus and Earth, conditions aren't thought to be extreme enough to make phosphine molecules in the absence of life. Either some kind of metabolism or an unknown chemical process would be required to explain the high amounts of phosphine gas in the Venusian atmosphere. On Earth, various microbes make phosphine. Humans make it too, in meth laboratories and as part of the semiconductor industry. The team identified phosphine using two instruments that observe radio waves. First, in 2017, Cardiff University's Jane Greaves and colleagues found that what could be phosphine with the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope in Hawaii. But that observation needed confirmation, and in 2019, the team turned to a more powerful instrument, the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, or ALMA, a network of 66 radio dishes in the Chilean high desert. In the ALMA data, the team found a faint signal at a frequency where phosphine molecules in the Venusian atmosphere would absorb energy, known as a spectral line. If phosphine really is on Venus in the large quantities seen, the team argued, its presence would be tough to explain if it were not biologically produced. A new reanalysis of data from the Pioneer Venus probe, which visited Venus in the late 1970s, tentatively supports the presence of phosphine, although it cannot confirm it. Yet some scientists were dubious. At the time, ALMA Observatory scientist John Carpenter questioned the way scientists on the original team analyzed the data, suggesting that their procedure may have generated spurious signals. Additionally, astronomers generally look for multiple spectral lines produced by the same molecule to confirm its presence, observations the team didn't have. At the time of the announcement, the team was still seeking confirmation of the detection in the form of spectral lines that could be observed with infrared telescopes, observations that were delayed by the ongoing pandemic. Now, a different team, including Greaves and Sousa Silva of the original detection team, has taken a look at Venus using archival data from a different telescope, NASA's InfraLab telescope facility in Hawaii. Those observations from 2015 do not indicate a strong signal from phosphine. Led by the Paris Observatory's Therese Encrenaz, the study authors conclude that the data put an upper limit on the level of phosphine possible in the Venusian atmosphere, that is one-fourth the originally detected amount. The observations also suggest that any phosphine would need to be at altitudes above the planet's clouds, which astronomers think would be unlikely because the gas would quickly break down. Sousa Silva points to several possible explanations for the lack of phosphine in the infrared observations. Phosphine quantities may vary over time, or the infrared observations might not have probed the clouds deeply enough to detect the gas at the reported levels. Even now, the team doesn't necessarily agree on what altitude the infrared observations measure. While Encrenaz and members of the discovery team sorted through the IRTF data, two other teams reprocessed the original data used to make the detection. Neither of the new independent analyses of that data could find reliable traces of the gas. The first group, comprising more than two dozen researchers, failed to find evidence for phosphine in both the JCMT and the ULMA data. JCMT did detect a spectral line at the right frequency, but the team suggests it can be explained by sulfur dioxide gas in the atmosphere of Venus, which happens to generate a spectral line in the same place. It's a well-known gas on Venus, Nixon says. Not at all controversial. The data from ALMA, which produces extremely high-resolution observations, was more complicated to analyze. Bright, nearby objects such as Venus can cause problems for ultra-sensitive telescope arrays like ALMA. To put a signal from the Venus observations, astronomers had to remove radio noise produced by Earth's atmosphere, by Venus itself, and even equipment at the observatory. This is a very tricky data reduction, says Brian Butler of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, who studies solar system objects using ALMA and worked on the new analysis. He says, Venus is a very bright object, it's large, and even their detection of the line, were it real, is still a faint line. To make matters more complicated, the ALMA Observatory recently identified an error in its calibration system that produced a spectrum of Venus with a lot of noise for Greaves and her colleagues to work with. Using a technique called polynomial fitting, the original discovery team looked for phosphine spectral line by mathematically removing background noise around the region in the spectrum where phosphine should be. In principle, this type of analysis allows astronomers to predict which parts of the observation are noise and which are real signals. Once the team smoothed out the spectrum to remove excess noise, astronomers concluded that the phosphine signal was significant enough to call it a detection. But other astronomers are skeptical of the team's data processing. To pull the phosphine signal out of a messy data set, the team subtracted the background noise using high-order polynomial, which means more variables were used to model the data than is typical. In addition, the team modeled the background noise by looking at portions of the spectrum outside the area where they expect to find a signal from phosphine, a method that normally prevents unknown noise from obscuring a possible signal. However, combining a high-order polynomial with a noisy data set makes it possible to artificially create a false signal where phosphine would be. Meredith McGregor, an astronomer at the University of Colorado, says, "You can always improve the fit to a data set by adding more variables, but you need to define a metric that tells you when to stop. At some point, you end up fitting noise and inflating signals that aren't real. Butler downloaded the ALMA data and started from scratch. Redid some of the initial calibrations and then processed the data as he normally would. He didn't find any evidence of phosphine in the planet's spectrum. I just used what, in my experience, is best practices for reducing this kind of data, Brian Butler said. If you don't do it the way they do it, you don't get this feature of phosphine. Additionally, when his colleagues treated the data using the same method as the original discovery team, they found that the polynomial fitting could produce full spectral lines. Another analysis of the ALMA data led by Leiden Observatory's Ignaz Snellen and colleagues also failed to find any sign of phosphine. Similarly, that team reported that high-order polynomial fitting could create multiple spurious spectral lines. Greaves and her team have declined to comment on the new analysis of the ALMA observations until the observatory has had a chance to reprocess the data. These attempts to confirm the phosphine discovery are exactly how science is supposed to work, many of the astronomers say. Independent replication is not as common as it should be, although it is a key part of verifying discoveries. A final determination regarding the presence of phosphine on Venus will have to wait for the new analysis to be peer-reviewed and published, and then scrutinized themselves, and perhaps for additional observations of the planet. We need follow-up observations, so we're not relying on a few very noisy data sets, Sousa Silva says. The lesson is to push for more analysis and more data. With time, the researchers are confident they will get to the bottom of the phosphine mystery. Nixon says, I think science is self-correcting, and ideally in this day and age, with the internet and so on, we don't take years to self-correct things. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. If this result is wrong, Brian Butler says, it wouldn't be the first.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Addiction of Sinning. The awful consequences of sin is that it breaks our relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and separates us from Him, resulting in spiritual death because sin disqualifies us from living in Allah's presence. This is how bad sinning is. We sometimes think that, oh, we just violated a law of Allah, but there are other places we are being so good. We are praying on time, we are fasting, we are doing this, we are doing that. So we feel that sinning is something insignificant, something minor. No, brothers and sisters, take this worldview, take this perspective that every time we sin, we disconnect ourselves from our Creator, Allah. Now, this is going to bring a revolution in your thought process. It's not just an act that Allah didn't like. No, it's us intentionally disconnecting ourselves from our Lord and our Creator. When we become involved in sin, we start a tragic process. At first, we may regard sin with horror and shame, but when we indulge in it continuously, we slowly become immune to it, and worse, we yearn for it. Humans are highly adaptable and intelligent. When we continue to commit a sin over and over again, we might still feel ill at ease and truly guilty about it, but gradually our consciences will adjust. Each sin makes the next one a bit easier. Over time, that sin will become entirely acceptable, and we continue to indulge in it without qualm, oblivious to the destruction it is causing. Sin, like a drug, is addictive. As the addiction grows stronger than our will and desire to fight it, our ideal depreciates until it is completely gone. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the addiction of sinning, and we said it's like a drug. May Allah protect all the believers out there, including myself, inshallah, from this addiction of sinning. The will is the power or faculty that allows our mind to make choices and then act to carry them out. So our will, when it is weaker than this addiction, this is where the problem begins. There's an old saying that goes, sow an act and reap a habit. Sow a habit and reap a character. Sow a character and reap a destiny. At first, a person may engage in a forbidden pleasure against his will, unable to resist the temptation due to weakness, curiosity, or sheer carnality. If the practice continues, he sins because he cannot help doing to. He is becoming addicted to that sin. Gradually, as he continues to give in to that sin, it develops into a habit. He then considers that sin, this habit, to be almost a necessity. As that necessity takes roots in his life, destiny is produced. See how the process works. So what is the solution to this? How can we stop and prohibit ourselves from getting indulged and stuck in this process? Well, brothers and sisters, the advice that the scholars of Islam give to us is that we have to be careful about sinning at the very first level. Avoid sinning in every position. Be very careful as soon as you encounter a sin. Otherwise, there is a good chance that you are going to get addicted to that. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight. Cathay Pacific Airlines, convinced that digital proof of coronavirus vaccination will bring about the return of safe international travel, asked its pilots and crew to try out a new mobile app that showed their vaccination status on a recent flight from Hong Kong to Los Angeles, California. New York has rolled out Excelsior Pass, billed by the state as a free, fast, and secure way to present digital proof of COVID-19 vaccination in case reopening sports and entertainment venues requires proof of attendee status. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Cheryl Gay Stolberg and Adam Liptak. The piece is titled, "Likely Legal, Vaccine Passports Emerge as the Next Coronavirus Divide." Stay with us for more. Cathay Pacific Airlines, convinced that digital proof of coronavirus vaccination will bring about the return of safe international travel, asked its pilots and crew to try out a new mobile app that showed their vaccination status on a recent flight from Hong Kong to Los Angeles. New York has rolled out its Excelsior Pass, billed by the state as a free, fast, and secure way to present digital proof of COVID-19 vaccination in case reopening sports and entertainment venues require proof of attendee status. And Walmart, America's largest private employer, is offering electronic verification apps to patients vaccinated in its stores so they can easily access their vaccine status as needed, the company says. Around the country, businesses, schools, and politicians are considering vaccine passports, digital proof of vaccination against the coronavirus, as a path to reviving the economy and getting Americans back to work and play. Businesses especially fear that too many customers will stay away unless they can be assured that the other patrons have been inoculated. But the idea is raising charged legal and ethical questions. Can businesses require employees or customers to provide proof, digital or otherwise, that they have been vaccinated when the coronavirus vaccine is ostensibly voluntary? Can schools require that students prove that they have been injected with what is still officially an experimental prophylaxis, the same way they require longer-proofed vaccines for measles and polio? And finally, can governments mandate vaccinations or stand in the way of businesses or educational institutions that demand proof of vaccination? Legal experts say the answer to all of these questions is generally yes, though in a society so divided, politicians are already girding for a fight. Government entities like school boards and the army can require vaccinations for entry, service, and travel, practices that flow from a 1905 Supreme Court ruling that said states could require residents to be vaccinated against smallpox or pay a fine. A community has the right to protect itself against an epidemic of disease which threatens the safety of its members, Justice John Marshall Harlan wrote in Jacobson v. Massachusetts, the 1905 case. Private companies, moreover, are free to refuse to employ or do business with whomever they want, subject to only a few exceptions, ones that do not include vaccination status. And states can probably override that freedom by enacting a law barring discrimination based on vaccination status. But as the nation struggles to emerge from the worst public health crisis in a century, the arrival of digital vaccine verification apps, a modern version of the World Health Organization's yellow card that that provides international proof of yellow fever vaccination has generated intense debate over whether proof of vaccination can be required at all. On Tuesday, the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, became the latest Republican governor to issue an executive order barring state agencies and private entities receiving funds from the state from requiring proof of vaccination. The World Health Organization, WHO, citing equity concerns, also said on Tuesday that it is currently did not support mandatory proof of vaccination for international travel. Others are moving forward. Universities like Rutgers University, Brown University, and Cornell have already said they will require proof of vaccination for students this autumn. The Miami Heat this week became the first team in the NBA to open special vaccinated-only sections. And though businesses have yet to announce outright bans on unvaccinated clientele, some states and technology firms are preparing. At least 17 companies or non-profit organizations are developing websites or apps that might be used by sporting venues, restaurants, and other businesses seeking to keep their customers and employees safe, according to Joel White, the executive director of the Health Innovation Alliance, a broad coalition of health providers, technology companies, employers, and insurers. Airlines including JetBlue and United Airlines are also testing the Common Pass app, developed by the Commons Project, a non-profit trust dedicated to using technology to help people control their personal information. Airlines for America, the trade group for the nation's major carriers, opposes making proof of vaccination mandatory for air travel, but would like a clean, easy way for travelers to show their status. Other countries may require proof of vaccination, and the apps can also be used to prove negative coronavirus test results, which the United States requires for international travelers. On the face of things, requiring proof of vaccination seems a lot like no shoes, no shirt, no service, said Mark Tushnet, a law professor at Harvard University. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, already provides everyone who is vaccinated a card that can serve as proof, and people can always carry paper records of negative coronavirus tests. But industry leaders liken digital vaccination apps to security screening services like TSA PreCheck. It is not required, but it might make the travel experience smoother. Backers of digital vaccination cards are pressing the Biden administration to become involved, at least by setting standards for privacy and for verifying the accuracy of the records. The White House, though, is clearly skittish. The government is not now, nor will be, supporting a system that requires Americans to carry a credential, Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, said on Tuesday. Jen Psaki added, there will be no federal vaccination database and no federal mandate requiring everyone to obtain a single vaccination credential. She promised that the Biden administration would provide some form of guidance, most likely in the form of questions and answers, about privacy, security, discrimination, and concerns. Last week, the chief technology officer of the Department of Health and Human Services held a conference call with state and local health officials who are mystified by the administration's reticence. It's going to be necessary to have this, and there is going to have to be some kind of system where it's verified, said Dr. Marcus Plescia, the chief medical officer of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. Dr. Marcus Plescia added, I think everybody in our network is a little bit perplexed by the way the federal government seems to be at arm's length with this. One arm of the government has offered some help. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has told employers that they can mandate coronavirus vaccination because public health comes first. But if an employee cannot get vaccinated because of a disability or a sincerely held religious belief, and a company cannot make an accommodation, the agency said, then it would be lawful for the employer to exclude the employee from the workplace.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz.
In the beginning of the spread of the coronavirus, we did not even have masks. Our youth and our people produced masks and disinfectants at home and at mosque. It was really a manifestation of cutting the dependence on foreign countries. And we continued to move forward until we faced the challenge to produce a vaccine. Today, vaccines are thankfully being tested and produced in several ways. This is a source of reputation for the country. Fair-minded foreign analysts are praising our country for this. This path was tested by the Iranian nation and they will continue it by Allah's favor.
Turning threats into opportunities by relying on domestic forces.
Thousands of youth in knowledge-based companies and production centers are busy manufacturing products under foreign sanctions, and these products both have better quality and, as I said earlier, are cheaper. The same is true of other fields of knowledge. No matter how much we speak about the talents of our youth, it is really not enough.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger than my
In the area of new sciences such as nanotechnology, we are among the top countries in the world. As for scientific articles, according to scientific databases in the world, in the course of the past 20 years, this is because nanotechnology is a new science, Iran wrote, for example, 10 articles in the area of nano. But in 2020, it produced 12,000 articles. In other words, in the space of 20 years, we improve from 10 articles to 12,000. Such tasks are thankfully being carried out in the country. These are important achievements. As for military areas, the country's progress is thankfully becoming more and more noticeable, brilliant, and in the eyes of some people, astonishing, because these military products increase the country's foreign security. This is very important for the country. Now the army is, by the will of Allah, the fortress of the subjects. The military forces are in fact a fortress for the security of the country. Therefore, the threat of sanctions, which is a real threat and a crime in the true sense of the word, could be turned into an opportunity if we rely on our domestic capacities and forces.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.